a teenager in the 90s was simple. No TikTok trends, no cyberbullying. But in 2024, everything's changed. The average UK child gets a mobile phone at age 10. 98% of teenage girls have faced cyberbullying. But what if there was a trusted tool to help teens safely navigate this digital world? Today on The Startup Leap, we speak with Jazz, co-founder of Luna, who shares how she and her co-founder Joe turned an MBA class project at Oxford into a global teenage health app. In just 2 years, Luna is trusted by over 100,000 teenagers across 15 countries.
And then we basically went home and had a raft of messages on, like, via email, like, where can we download the app? Can we come do work experience for you? And we were like, wow, there really is like a need for this.
So, settle in and listen to the episode. You're about to hear something amazing.
Welcome to The Startup Leap, the number one podcast interviewing startup founders who have taken the leap into starting their own businesses.
Here on The Startup Leap, we hear real, raw, and relatable stories of these entrepreneurs, how they've navigated taking the leap, and the decisions they've made. We're your hosts.
I'm Yvonne.
And I'm Maria.
And this is the Startup Leap podcast.
Yvonne and Maria are partners at Local Globe and OpenSeed VC, respectively. Local Globe and OpenSeed are independent of the Startup Leap podcast. Any statements made by Maria, Yvonne, or the Startup Leap guests are solely their view and are not advice. Endorsements by the Startup Leap, its guests, Maria and Yvonne.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Startup Leap. And this time we're doing something a little different. We often think about entrepreneurs as either arriving at a destination or starting out, but many of the founders that we know were once in a process. So today we have an incredible guest that I can't wait for you to meet, who is the founder of a teenage well-being app, creating a whole new category. And I can't wait for you to hear about our story. We did our MBA together, right, Jazz? And yeah, Jazz is incredible and I can't wait for us to get into the episode. So welcome. Thank you for making it, Jazz.
No, thank you for having me, honestly. So excited. Yeah. Good to catch up. Yeah. And yeah, very happy to share my story.
Before we even go into it, I guess if I were to ask, like, who is Jazz? Because you are a ball of energy. You are incredible. No, I love your energy. And I think, like, you stay very authentic. It's one of the things I quite like about you. Knowing you now, what, like, 4 years? Oh, my God, it's crazy.
It's gone so quick.
I know. So tell me, if you were to describe yourself, if someone asked you, and I know that there's many different ways that can go, but what would you say very quickly? Who's Jazz?
What would I say? Well, I'd get in one key thing, which is obviously my nationalities. I have to get it in for every conversation. So I'm half Armenian, it's got that Kimmy K vibe. And just gotta throw that in. And half Maltese. And I do think that that mix is, yeah, like, really important to my identity. So do try and get into every conversation, because got to represent. So you're half Armenian, half Maltese. I'm from South London. Also got to get
Where
that
in. South London?
Brixton.
Okay.
Yep. And very high energy, like you said. Love karaoke. That's where you'll find me when I'm not building Luna.
We were talking about karaoke just now.
Literally.
Yeah. What's your favorite karaoke, like, go-to?
Go-to. Always got to be my fellow Armenian, Cher.
Oh,
did you know she's Armenian?
Cher Belief.
Yeah, got to represent. So, yeah, what about you?
Oh, God.
I'll tell you mine. Anything to do with Spice Girls.
Yeah, which one?
Love it. So, if you want to be my lover.
We have musical talent
in
the house.
We have. No, God, that's a good one.
I'm really shy to say mine because it's
quite
not a song.
But
yeah. No, I think Cher is great. Like, Cher is an amazing choice. Like, isn't it? Do you believe? Yeah. Everyone knows. Oh, yeah, like,
yeah. I can't,
like,
sing, by the way. I just,
like, you just love karaoke.
Exactly.
But yeah, no, but that's incredible. So tell me, Jazz has high energy. She loves life. Have you always thought you would build something? Like, what's your background, professionally speaking?
Yeah. Did I always think I would build something? I think in my head, I would have liked to, but the reality is I also like nice things. my mum likes nice things. And so, yeah, having a job with a comfortable salary was something that I always wanted. I also come from immigrant background, immigrant parents. So being able to provide for them through that sort of security and comfortable salary was also something top of mind. So Very typical, did like law at university, was...
I think we have a theme here. We've had a lot of lawyers on the podcast.
I mean, I was very much, I don't want to say forced into law, but like, you know, it was like law.
Strongly encouraged.
Strongly encouraged. And out of like medicine, engineering and law, that
this
was...
This is so common. Even in like African households, you're like, it's either you're a doctor or a lawyer, an accountant.
Yeah. Otherwise, else, you're a failure.
Can't do math.
Sorry.
You can kind of write.
Not going to make
like,
it.
Okay, yeah. But like did the law degree and just, it just wasn't going to be my calling. So I ended up going into consulting, good career. And to be honest, I had a great 5 years there, but it got to a point where I was like, I think I'm at my limits here. I'm always trying to change things in a big company.
There's a pushback.
And I think I've just got more to give to this world. So went to do the MBA, which is obviously where I met you, Maria.
And Oxford,
exactly. I can see you representing. truthfully, like never thought I'd come out with my own company because I was like, so much risk. You know, am I really ready to take that? I like the idea of like having a nice salary afterwards. I think I wrote I wanted to go and work at a scale up, which would have that nice.
And you also had VC on the horizon. I had VC with the seed fund.
I was also exploring like anything entrepreneurial. Yeah. So like scale up, accelerator, VC as well. Yeah. So obviously Oxford Seed Fund, which is where we met. But truthfully, I never went in there being like, I'm going to go and find my own thing. Because I was like, I want a six-figure salary after this. Like, that's why I'm really doing the MBA. And now I'm a founder. So, but you know what? Okay. That will come. Yeah. And yeah, I feel so grateful for that Deloitte journey. Because if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't have done the MBA. Yeah. I, you know, didn't get the promotion I wanted, which made me reconsider like what I was doing. And then I went to do my MBA off the back of it. And met my co-founder, obviously met you. You were an early advocate of Luna and the rest is history. So yeah, I don't regret sort of being the pushed process, into that career or that process. Yeah. Even though it was a bit painful to get there, I wouldn't be where I am now, I don't think, if I didn't have that.
And like growing up, was there any, did you, you know, there's always the typical, you sold at a lemonade stand, you like, did you do any of that? If you, in retrospect, could think, were there any insights or things that, you know, little Jazz was like doing that was showing that she would love to solve problems?
Yeah, it's really interesting because my mum's side of the family, so the Armenian side, they are a family of entrepreneurs. So like my granddad had a really famous restaurant in Lebanon, like my uncle entrepreneur. But my dad's side, accountant, like quite
formal,
should we say. So I think I'd always seen these like role models. And in terms of me, I think there was a low-key sort of hustle Jazz because I'd always be performing, you know, friends came over, we'd be doing like dance shows or pantomimes, but then at the end we'd like take hats and ask for money afterwards and be like tips, like anyone, we take credit cards as well, and but we were always performing to the point where my mum was like, is this ever gonna like stop? So no formal lemonade stands, just like shows where we would hope to get some tip. I mean, we made like a little bit of money,
but it was there, it was like that creativity, and I think I'm hearing like expression, bringing yourself to the table, and I imagine that entrepreneurship allows you do that much better than I guess a traditional structure where you probably have to be a square peg fitting a square hole, and anything deviating from that
definitely
might be a problem.
Even when I was at Deloitte, I found myself always thinking about like ideas, talking to my friends who were also, you know, quite creative or entrepreneurial, and be like, oh, we do it like this, we do it like this, but never willing to take the leap. You know, it takes so much to leave a job with a good salary and stability and a job that you enjoy as well. So I think I always had, my brain would always go to entrepreneurial places, but never really have the guts to take the leap and do it. This is huge.
What was it that made you take the leap, given that, you know, you wanted that six-figure salary, you wanted to continue buying nice things, and obviously entrepreneurship in the initial phase, not quite that, right? And so, so yeah, just curious, what was it that made you take that leap and, you know, want to build something?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. I think there was a couple of things. The first is, I think the point of time in my life that I was at was good. And I think that is a luck factor. So I'd just taken a year out of working to do my MBA.
Right.
So I'd had a year of like no salary, of no structure, having fun, meeting new people. And I just sort of thought, if there was any time to do this, it's now, because I can put a time stop to it. Yeah. So I'll try it for a year. If I can raise money, if I can get something off the ground, if people are using it, then great. And if not, you know, I'm very lucky to have a good education behind me. I will find something else. So I think that timing factor was one piece. Second of all, like the idea and the mission behind Luna. So it's, as Maria said, this health and well-being platform for teenage girls. Like the fact that does not exist in the world right now, I was like, I cannot go through my 30s, like knowing another generation of women have to go through like what I went through without the advice. However, now they have TikTok to get fake news from, to have even more pressures put on them. I was like, I can't stand for that. Plus also there's a massive opportunity here. Like we know parents will pay for this. We know schools want access to this. They are the next generation of consumer brands want access to this audience. So I was like, if we don't do this, somebody else will. Yeah. And I will always look back and be like, actually, like that could have been us building Luna. So I think there was that sort of FOMO effect. And then lastly, I mean, I was so nervous to tell my mum and dad that I'm going into the PT business, essentially, like after, you know, after...
Actually, that's what it is.
Literally, you know, oh, what are you doing after the MBA? I'm building a puberty app. Like, I was like, they're just...
There's no frame of reference. There's nothing like that.
Yeah.
It's almost like creating a whole new market, actually.
Literally. And I just thought they were going to be like, what are you doing? Like, you spent all this money. How are we even going to explain this to our to our friends? But actually, they were really on board as well. And I think having them behind me and Joe and being like, this is a really good idea. Like, I really believe in you both and just think this will work. As well as my husband, who, you know, I just think being a founder is so hard and you need to have support, whether that's through your parents or your partners. I think that was like the third part of it, really. And yeah, so I think the combination of those three things and a bit of like reality, like, you know, I said, let the timing in terms of like, let's do it for a year. If it doesn't work, you know, I'm not stupid. I'm not going to try and keep doing something if it has no legs. So yeah, those three things together, it's a very long way of answering your question, but I think it's important to know that there's a bit of luck, a bit of timing, support, and then obviously the idea itself.
Yeah. How did you go from the idea to actually building out the first version, making it happen? What are some of the things that went through your mind? I'd love to hear about that journey.
Yeah. So the idea for Luna came off the MBA, and basically on the Oxford MBA program, there's a module called the Entrepreneurship Project. Most MBAs do it. It's a bit like Dragon's Den meets The Apprentice. Find a problem, find a team, pitch an idea to your professors, but also real VCs as well. At Oxford, I was always, you always put in teams. This was the only team you could, the only project you could find your own team. And let's just put it this way, in the teams I was put in, sorry if you're listening to this, I was always doing like a lot of the work. Like Maria, you've been in a team with me before. You know what,
I'm also extra.
Like I was like, no, if I'm paying for this MBA, like I'm getting the best mark.
Yeah, and I just think it's like team dynamics sometimes. There's just always like one or two people who are like really, really taking the entire team up. And there are people that add some things and they're so important, but probably not as much as everyone else. But yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, cut a really long story short. For this team, I was like, I'm going to find like five other amazing women who also bring that energy. So we went team first. We were talking about ideas, we were talking about our experiences as women and how actually wherever we were from in the world, there was this lack of education we had about adolescence, teen health. And that was the idea we pitched for Luna to our professors and to investors. And actually they were the first ones that turned around and were like, who is doing this after the MBA? Like, this is a really good idea. We see, you know, thousands of pitch decks, but we've never seen a sort of health and well-being platform specifically for teens. That was the first light bulb moment back in May 2021. Mm-hmm. I was doing my internship that summer in VC, but my brain just kept going back to like, actually, is this, this maybe is a good idea? Speaking to loads of founders, listening to their journey. And actually, Joe and I decided to go back to our old schools that summer and actually speak to teenagers and ask them.
How did you meet Joe? You've mentioned Joe just twice. Who is Joe?
Sorry, how Joe's like basically now like, she's actually really my partner. No, she is my co-founder, basically like a second sister to me. We met on the MBA program. So that is who Joe is. But yeah, Joe and I were like, let's go and talk to teenagers. Mm-hmm. We went back to our old schools. We set up workshops. They were telling us how they were using TikTok today, that education still isn't really giving them what they need. And then we basically went home and had a raft of messages on like via email, like, where can we download the app? Can we come do work experience for you? And we were like, wow, there really is like a need for
that
this.
Early validation.
That was validation. Yeah. And I think that was like the, let's go and do this. And in terms of how we built it, well, off the back of these teenagers messaging us, we applied for a private grant of like 20K.
A grant? That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Because usually people would maybe bootstrap or try
we
to
didn't
get
have any
for...
money to bootstrap. I know, I just, that money got burnt on the MBA. Don't get me wrong, it was worth it.
Yeah.
It was expensive.
Yeah. No, you're right. So you went the grant direction. Was that more happenstance? Was it more deliberate? Like, how did that come about?
I cannot remember who or how it came on our doorstep, but it was a consumer grant for £20,000. And it was Savitri Tan's grant. I don't know if you know her from the VC ecosystem. And Joe and I like pitched our entrepreneurship project pitch, which by now I think said we were making 100 million in revenue, which by the way, we're not. But I look back
almost
on this,
there.
When,
almost
almost there.
There.
When I look coming, back on this pitch coming. Deck and I'm like, wow, it was really like 10x, 100x growth. Anyway, and yeah, she gave us the first grant, and that £20,000 has never lasted, you know, that amount of money lasted us so long. But essentially what we did is we kept talking to users and Jo upskilled herself in a no-code tool, Adalo. I went out and found these like medics who would create free content for us, and we basically stitched together the world's worst version of Luna and got like 100 teenagers on it. And it was stitched together with like Excel, YouTube videos, emails, everything. But these teenagers were using it. And for us, that was like, it looks terrible. It doesn't work very well. But it's validation that teens
want
something.
And because I think it's so important that if you don't have the resources to go out and build a first version of the app, just be scrappy and get something out and 100%. Test it. You can learn so much from it.
Literally. Especially when the alternative is horrible.
Yeah.
I feel like when the bar is so low in the market, as an early stage company, really, even if you gave something that was just better, you could think it was marginally better, but to the user experience, because they've been so neglected, it's actually exponentially better, even though it's a first version. So you still cringe as your first version right now.
It was really bad. Like, I'm sorry, Joe, if you're listening to this now. It wasn't that bad. I mean, it was amazing. Like, we don't come from technical backgrounds.
Talk about that. You don't come from technical backgrounds.
No, Joe and I both come from consulting backgrounds. Joe from a finance background, me from more of a strategy and ops.
Right.
It makes us great executors, which I actually think is really fundamental to being an early stage founder. And so we just spoke to the right people who could upskill us, and then we executed. I mean, I had no idea what I was doing with content at the time, but you just figure it out, don't you? And same with Joe with product and tech. I mean, now we have like a tech team and people to actually help us make it look good. And it is a really good app.
Oh, it does look good.
But yeah, you just have to be scrappy. You just got to do it yourself. And actually, there's at the early stages, it should be us doing it. It shouldn't be somebody else directing where the button goes or what the product looks like and stuff.
So you went from this really scrappy version to now having a tech team. What was that journey like? And what were some of the initial things you're thinking about in building a team? And how did you go about building the team, essentially, because building a team is incredibly hard, right?
It really is. And actually, I think something people don't talk about is actually managing that team. And especially at the early stages, you're all so passionate about what you're doing. You know, truthfully, you can't afford to pay them the best salaries, yet they are working so incredibly hard.
They've got to buy into the vision.
Yeah.
Literally. And I mean, our team is amazing. We are like a Swiss Army knife team. We can do everything.
How large is the team now?
We're only six, but you know, we can do everything from AI, paid ads, content. But like I say, everyone's working very hard. Yeah. And it's like, how do you keep them like motivated so they don't burn out, you know? It's really, really difficult. So how do we build the team? Well, we did our first raise off the back of our very scrappy pilot. And obviously what I did was went back to the investors that told us this was a great idea on the MBA. And I was like, right, cough up. Because
put your money where your mouth
is. Because I love it. I just gave up that salary. The handbags, the new flat for this scrappy life, which I'm loving. And they did come in. So like some of those initial investors were like, yep, no, I back this. We're in. So we raised like our first pre-seed in the May after that. And that was enough for us to bring in a technical team, so Russ and Chris, and then it was just Russ, Chris, Joe and I doing everything until I was like, I can't do content, as in like managing, working with the medics and the actual operations right. of the app, as well as like growth and marketing and everything. So we then brought in our next person, you know, then they did as much as they could until they could bring in another person. So truthfully, we've all had to work the roles until we're like, we are max and we now need a specialist or we need an additional pair of hands. And I actually just think that's how it should be. For us, we don't want to like overhire and then have to reduce the time, the team even. So yeah, but very lucky to have an amazing team at Luna. And you know, at the beginning, nobody had heard of us. It was really hard to get people. When I tell you now, people are emailing like, do you have any spare roles? It's like, it's just amazing to see things switch up. Even with like the medics, to begin with, we were like, where do we find doctors? But now I have like a really long wait list and a community of like gynecologists, dermatologists who want to like work with us as well. It's really
How many
good.
Users do you have right now?
We're coming up to 100,000.
That is insane.
In 162 different countries, which I think is amazing because we've not actually launched officially in another country. We've just switched it on in the app store. Yeah, and I think social media, word of mouth, referrals takes you like a long way. So that it is incredible to think. There's one point where we were like, how are we going to get to our first 1,000 users? I remember sitting in this WeWork with Joe and I was like, we're getting like one download a day. Like how are we going to tick that up? And, you know, we figured out what that growth lever is.
How did you navigate that? How did you figure out? Because I think getting those initial users can be so tricky. It takes having to try out a lot of things, right? So how did you go about doing that and getting to where you are today, 100,000 users?
Yeah. And honestly, I really remember this like so vividly because I was like, we really need to have more than one download today. To get to the first 1,000, it wasn't scalable at all. We basically...
But sometimes you have to do the things that don't scale, right?
Exactly. I know. Everyone's like, why combinator? Yeah, yeah. Like, way of doing things. But it is true. Especially when you have, like, no brand presence on Instagram, TikTok. Like, nobody's heard of you. Why are you going to download this app? So we basically did a roadshow to schools. And we would just go to schools and talk to teenagers and essentially get them to try the apps. We wouldn't say, like... download it, but we'd get them to try it, and then they'd try it and they'd love it, and then they would download it. Mm-hmm. And we basically did a school roadshow.
And did you have the buy-in from the school? So you'd go direct to the schools? Yeah, and
exactly. It'd be like, we'd love to like speak to your students, show them our app, get their input. It wasn't like a hard sell, like we want to come and promote our app. I think we got our first 2,000 users like that. Then we introduced the referral scheme, you know, refer someone, get points, that then doubles your user base. Okay, now follow our Instagram, TikTok accounts. So that probably got us to maybe like 10,000. But then we were like, okay, we need to grow quicker than this. And it was testing different content types on TikTok. And the one that landed well was the ones that didn't have Joe and I on it. Like grey-haired millennials like, hey, you need Luna. It was the community-based ones. Right. And the way that worked was a teenager just like sent in a video and was like, hey, I've created this for Luna. Can you post it on your account? And it was like a get ready with me while I tell you about this app called Luna. And it just took off. And then we realized that actually our strategy on TikTok needs to be like teenagers, basically showing girlhood, showing what it's like to be a girl, talking about the app. And that's basically what we stuck to. And it's done really well for us. So that's how we've done it today.
Yeah, love it.
You know, I remember seeing you back then, you and Joe would like go slanging at like tube stops, and I realized slanging is not like, it's an Uber term for like just hustling, like going out and like trying to get people to download the app. And like I remember you having a sign with Luna on it and you're talking to people at the tube.
It still happens. I was at Taylor
it's
Swift.
It's not a reflect. It's like that was last week.
Oh, literally. I was at Taylor Swift whenever she came the end of June, because that's where our audience is. And we were there with the banner, with the little like bracelet, Luna like lollipops, everything. I thought people wouldn't take lollipops or strangers. But I was a bit like, actually, I'm not sure this is the right thing to do, but it's ordered now, so we're doing it. And truth be told, it's not like we got thousands of downloads from it, but it's what we did building. Get was loads of content from it, which then got us viral on TikTok. And we found a micro influencer at Taylor Swift. She reshared it. That we got like a million views on that. So yeah, I think doing things that don't scale, that hustle, that creates good content. And that is the stuff at the moment that gets you viral and gets you growing.
And you recently also sponsored or like bylined like a girls basketball team or something like that.
Yeah. So the London Lions women's basketball team, they, well, as many sports teams do, like they want to try and get more young women into sport. Luna, perfect partnership opportunity. So we were lucky to be their sort of partner sponsor in the women's finals. And we only went and like won it. And it was amazing because on the final sort of goal, I think they could have got, I'm not a basketball can I say basketball games are a vibe? Like
really?
There's like a DJ there, they're playing really good tunes. It was really good. As I scored the last shot, Luna was sort of on the LED headlines, and like obviously the BBC News like covered it, everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was just there. But it was really, really good. We brought like our community down to watch the game. Even they were like, this is actually so cool. Like I've never considered basketball before. So yeah, some really cool partnership opportunities as well. As I said, like lots of people want access to this audience, or you know, want to help them in some way. And so yeah, Luna is the gateway to that.
Love it.
I'd love to talk about that fundraising bit, because you both had no tech background, consulting background, incredible executors, direct experience to the problem. To be honest, I don't know if I want two men building a period app or like a puberty app.
It happens
a
lot.
Yeah. So I'm like, there's also the fact that you fit, but then also the conventional heuristic for venture, she's like, oh, get someone who has tech experience, has built a consumer app. How did you navigate that in fundraising? Your first round, was it VCs? Was it angels? What did you... Yeah, tell me a bit about that experience.
Yeah, and it was hard, and it still is hard. I feel like part of your role as a founder is that you are always fundraising, or at least like thinking about, okay, well, you know, your cash is going to end in like however many months or years, so you're always working backwards, like, okay, so we need to go back out here, so here are the milestones. But the first one, I really don't think we appreciated like what we did at the time, because raising like £600,000 of nothing, like
that was the first round, £600,000,
that was the first round. Yeah, I think we were just like, oh, it's not as high as what other people have raised, like you see all these big tech headlines. I think if you can raise money full stop, whether that's 100,000, 200,000, 600,000 million, like that is amazing. But in terms of how we did it, well, like I said, didn't have any money ourselves to put into this. But what we did know is that some people around us who we'd like worked for, like old bosses and things like that, might be interested in backing us as people. To your point, we are good executors, but like, you know, VCs, they've never heard of Jazz and Joe before. They just see two sort of crusty old consultants. So we're like, okay, let's go back to our old bosses who we're really hard with and see if we can get, you know, something from them. So that was our first tranche came from. So we're able to get a bit of capital. Also, many of them had like daughters themselves, so could understand like the need for this. With that, we were then able to go to angels. Again, really hard. Like you can't break into these networks because you haven't got a product. You've got no traction. So I remember Easter weekend sending about like 250 cold emails and getting like three responses, one on a Sunday night from Scott Mackin, who's a real serial angel investor, and him being like, I'm interested in this, can you take a call on Easter Monday? Got him, and he unlocked quite a lot for us, because then we had someone to represent us and sort of talk about us to other angels and things like that. So then we had a small amount from angels, and then the last piece was going to VCs where we had contacts. And obviously that's where I was very fortunate to know Maria, and was like, can I have the opportunity to pitch Octopus? And you got me a foot in the door there. Still had to pitch, go through like the whole thing, but I think because we had had a large amount of commitments and had like a small a bit of allocation to fill, and obviously you knew me, you used your track record, you understood the issue. We were then able to close at 600. So yeah, that's how we did it. But it was hard.
It was not as simple as it sounded.
It was not as simple, and like, definitely, you know, no, definitely. It was really hard actually. Yeah, but we're really lucky to have like such an amazing first group of investors who have then made like, we did a pre-seed extension and they made that so much easier. But I also think credit to us, like we've also proved that, like we have worked really hard. We send our investor emails, updates. We're extremely transparent. And so I like to think, hopefully Maria.
No, you're absolutely.
We're like good founders as well.
No,
you know?
I think like first, if you think about the problem of puberty, like every woman knows this. Every woman goes through this. And then you're like, there is no digital companion in a digital first age. It's different in our time. And in our time, there was such like this information gap.
Totally.
it was either your mom was speaking or you heard something from your friends. Now,
and actually, you didn't really want to speak about it with your friends.
Exactly. And also, even when your mom was speaking, you were like, oh, you're like, cringe.
I don't want to speak about that with you either.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't want to have this conversation. But it's such a huge part of your life. You're transitioning into adulthood. Your hormones are changing. Your identity is evolving. You're having to make decisions about your health and well-being. 100%. And you're not even very much informed. So to me, it was a no-brainer. Yeah. It was like, the time is so huge. If you think about it from a VC standpoint, the time is so huge. And the people who experience the problem will have nuance into how to translate that into a digital product that serves, I guess, the billions of kids will always have who are transitioning to adulthood. So yeah, you were singing to the choir ever since.
But not everyone obviously saw that. Lots of people told us like there isn't a big enough target market. Yeah. I was like,
there are very many
of the population are women. I was like, you know, it's not just teens, we're helping parents here as well. No. Like we're helping open up a conversation or, you know, even have a conversation.
Yeah.
Like give a teenager the prompt to go and chat to your parent and say, I don't feel right or something isn't right. But we got a lot of pushback.
What were the most interesting ones? And even before you answer that, I do think that we've seen it time and time again. The best founders create markets. And I actually think it's a feature, not a bug. I say this a lot. Mm. If everyone saw the opportunity immediately, it would not be the opportunity that it is. Because then even from a risk and reward perspective, it gets priced in immediately. So to me, from a venture standpoint, that's an opportunity. I actually want, like, it's how the asset class should be. Not everyone should get it, but through your perseverance, through your insight, you through early backers, you pull through and then show them when it's a little too late to kind of come on board. So I think like it's a nature of the asset class. I don't think it's a diss to anyone. But yeah, that being said, what were the interesting things that kind of came about? This was when you had you have 100,000 users now.
Yeah, it is so mad.
It's insane. What were the issues? What were the things that kept coming up?
Lots of things like, we don't think teens will use this.
That right or wrong?
We have very strong engagement with both free and paid users. Yeah. So I think that is...
So you are monetizing already?
We are. Early monetization. Yeah. We're still trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
In terms of like what the perfect formula is, but we're testing, we're learning, and we're moving closer to those key KPIs. Yeah. I think we're in a time where monetization has to be on the agenda. We also don't want to build like this amazing product and have no, you know, monetization.
No way to make money.
So yeah, we are like working on that. So yeah, they don't need it. They don't want it. People won't pay for it. There's no, not a big enough market. There's no one to compare this to. First in is really like risky. And I'm like, but somebody has to do something. And like, yeah, I appreciate we are risky and there will be like copycats, but we'll have the community, we'll have the brand already. We have the insights, you know, with the OGs. We already have our community like jumping on like stuff to be like, well, I actually already use Luna. Like, I'm like, guys,
you're
chill.
You're becoming a status symbol. I love it.
Like, at Luna. And I'm like, oh, hi. Lots of stuff like that. Yeah, lots of that. And I think the too early thing is, I feel like we hear that even now, like you're too early.
Yeah, and sometimes I feel as if that too early thing's just a bit of a lazy excuse.
Yeah. And I think I'd rather someone just be honest and be like, actually, like,
would you prefer that though? Like, wouldn't you be like, if someone said, you know what, we just don't understand the problem?
I think I would though, because I'd be like, do you know what, they weren't the right investors. Yeah. Or actually, I don't believe you, truthfully, I don't think your metrics are good enough, or we look for stickier products, or it's not really our space. I think it's helpful because then you know next time not to pitch to them or even to recommend them to other founders. So I think another thing is like founders, just like VCs and investors talk, like we're obviously talking too, because you know, you get some like bad experiences with investors and people will put in the chat, like, have you spoken to this person? It's been like this person. So yeah, it's hard. It will continue.
Well, you're definitely far from where you started.
Maria,
scary.
Like, when I look at our pitch deck from last year, when we said we were going around trying to raise off like 9,000 users, and now it's at 100,000 users. Like, it just a year can make so much difference. Yeah. But you've got to shoot your shot. And if you don't, one thing we were trying to raise and trying to do a much bigger raise, and actually like we were hearing like, oh, okay, we were hearing too early. I'm like, okay, we're not going to be able to close what we wanted. Let's pivot. We'll take the extension. We'll listen to what you've got to say, and we'll go out again when we've got you know, finite route to revenue, and we know that we're just going to start scaling that. So yeah, you learn, you pivot, you figure it out, make that runway stretch.
Yeah,
stretch that runway.
I guess you're still quite early in your journey, but thinking about where you are today and, you know, the various like bumps and hurdles you faced along the way, looking back, what would you do differently, if anything at all?
What would we do differently? I think we could have maybe worked with our advisors a bit closer. And like that's something I'm starting to do now, like have bi-weekly meetings with them, but also maybe like bulked out our advisory board. That said, I think when you are early stage, it's really hard to bring on like great advisors if they don't know you. And actually now people know us, we have a bit more of like selection. So
it's a catch 22, almost like a chicken and an egg.
It is really.
It's like, okay.
But like now I know like we should bring a product person on, but like we, you know, we now have access, we were part of the Google for Startups program. We now have access to like
the AI one.
AI one. So it's like we can now get someone through that. It is a bit catch 22, but I think we should have worked with our advisors more, but we are starting to do that now. I think focus and prioritization, I think, and we still can be better at that. I think it's difficult when there is nothing in the market, you know, your brain, we could do this, we could do that. But actually, like, we still need to remember, like, what is the problem we're trying to solve, or who are we focusing on? And that can be like a future thing. So I think focus and prioritization, because as a founder, like, you are still actually building as well as doing everything. And then I think like the first year and a half, I didn't take a break. And like was very close to burnout. And now it's like every three, I think I just like then shortened my ability to like work in longer stages. Okay. If that makes sense. Because now every 3 months I'm like, yeah, I really need to have a break. So actually I think if I had just done that a bit earlier, that
you'd be more productive overall.
Productive, exactly. Because it is really tight and it is a long game. Like we are coming up to 3 years, which is mad. And a lot happens at work, but in your life as well. So, yeah, I think that's like the other thing. I think that's the other thing.
I'd love to talk about that, the life part, because it's often, you know, you see an entrepreneur, you forget that they're people too.
Totally.
There's a backdrop of personal experiences that's going on. As you navigated entrepreneurship, how did you balance that? Like you mentioned your husband, were you married before? I would just love to see the backdrop of your life off the, like while you're going through this experience, that's a whole new experience for you as an entrepreneur.
Totally. And I also think it's not just entrepreneurs, it's also like VCs and angels.
It's so kind that you say that. But everyone thinks of VCs, but I'm like, to be fair, I think entrepreneurs, your job is like 100 times harder.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I went to an event, it was like an angel event, and I was just having a normal conversation with an angel, and they were like, thank you for just not coming up to me and pitching me for money. And I was like, what do you mean? And they're like, people were literally just like, hi, I'm this, I'm building that. And they were like, hello, I'm a human as well. And I was like, oh my
God. Don't objectify me. Literally, like, I'm not just money.
Literally, I'm a human. Like, I don't know. So I also like recognize that there's pressures that come with that as well. But it is really hard, especially in the early stages when the company isn't stable. Yeah, it's not sustainable. Like Joe and I are still like a huge part of the business, and we do commit Monday to Saturday, unless it's like a wedding or baptism or something, to working on Luna, which is really hard because a lot of our friends, they want to go out. Yeah. Oh, why can't you go out? Like, and it's like, because I really need to get this off the ground. So we do that. And then I ring fence Sunday to largely being with my husband or doing something like
family.
With friends and stuff. Yeah, family friends. And friends. And I have had to be really like purposeful with my time. And I think it's hard. I really love friends. I love family. I'm quite a social person. I'm lucky to have great friendship groups. But that has been hard because I don't think they've always understood like the intensity of like what it's like. And even if I'm with them over dinner, like I'm thinking about like, oh my God, I need to do this. I need to do that. So this year I've really tried to just like, if I'm too tired or I really don't think I can, I just being like, I can't do it. And those friends who will understand will get it. And those who don't, like, then like, I think we just, like, we're not compatible anymore. And that has been really hard for me. I don't like letting people down. I want to be at things. I want to show up and bring, like, good energy, Jazz. Not like, oh my God, I'm so tired. I'm so stressed.
But you are human. Like, as an entrepreneur, especially, because you're often under-resourced.
Totally.
So it's like you're probably doing twice of what your capacity, you're like going on reserve. So I totally hear that, being deliberate about your time. And in terms of support systems, how did you navigate that? Because obviously you have friends, but then also, who did you surround yourself with for those really tough moments when it's like, I don't even know if this, what am I doing? Where you face doubt or exhaustion or insecurity.
Yeah.
How do you structure that system around you?
Definitely cry to Joe, who's my co-founder.
So the co-founder gets the hit first.
And the good thing is, like, we have completely different cycles as well from a period perspective. So if one day amazing. I'm like anxiety, she's like, no, I'm not feeling good. It's going to be fine. So yeah, I have to say, having a co-founder who is just, like I said, sister, best friend, but also like badass. Mm-hmm. I'm so lucky that's just never been a problem. And I'm really, really lucky. So I think having someone to share that experience with has been, you know, really helpful, invaluable. I think in times of like stress or second opinion, like when you need it immediately, my husband, he is like an unofficial advisor to Luna.
I think every partner is like a silent partner in a business.
Silent partner, silent operations. Oh my gosh. Like to begin, when we did this pilot, he was writing content for us. Like the poor guy, he's writing grant applications.
Like, does this sound right?
Literally. And he's
like, I always say, one of my really good friends always says, your partner will be your greatest asset or your greatest liability. And I'm just like,
honestly,
then definitely like,
oh, I remember
we need to get them to work.
100%. I'm so lucky. I mean, like, we did the MBA because it was COVID. He got to come to Oxford for the MBA. I mean, who was more popular than me on the MBA? I'm not joking.
At some point, we didn't know if he was not on the MBA.
Literally. Anyway, this podcast isn't about him. So, but it kind of is, because he, honestly, you know, when you're up at night and you're stressed, like, you're talking to them about it. And to be honest, I think it's really hard to be the partner of a founder, because you want to help them, but like, there's only so much you can do. So I think them, I think I go to my sister a lot as well. She's so smart, really got her head screwed on. Go to her. And then I think the other piece, when you're just like, I don't know what I'm doing, or like there's just so much on, is like the advisors. And just going to them with like, this is the facts of where the business are. This is what's on my mind. Like, help me structure what I need to focus on. Because I do think sometimes there's just so much. You're so in the weeds. You're just like, I don't know what I'm doing. And yeah, that's where we've really started to like have more of those conversations and things. So those are like my three support. And then I have like my friends for the fun times, but do they really like, I don't think they always see like as much as possible like the good version of Jazz, not like they're like chaotic,
freaking out,
messy, coffee cups everywhere, you know. So yeah.
One of the things I'd love to understand from your perspective, especially given you're in your process, like you're in progress. Someone said something incredible to me recently and it resonated, that like the process is the journey, like the process is the thing. It's not the destination, because it's always plus one. You need to do something better, even if you get to the end. And it's such a basic cliche thing, but it only really clicked to me like recently on like a visceral level. And in the middle, we're having this conversation, you're seeing how far you've come, but you're going to leave and you're going to have to face a very specific real thing in the business. There's this half a sad, like up and down feel at the early stages, where one moment is like, yes, I saw this. It's exactly right. I told them like, this is it. And then there's a point where you're like, oh, wow. Yeah, there's still so much. So while that up and down happens, how do you navigate that? Because the lows can be very low and the highs can be very high. How do you, especially whilst you're still in this place where it's like, I know, I feel very strongly that Luna is going to be incredible. It's going to be a household name, but it's not there yet. It's growing. You can see the early signs, but it's like, how do you manage that in between?
So yeah, it's such a good point. I mean, like in April, we had like our strongest month, you know, we had this basketball partnership. We got blue tick verified TikTok. Additional interest from investors. It was such a high. And then in May it was like, oh, is that it? Like there was like nothing to celebrate. We were building the foundations for like what was going to come next. And even that, like May was a bit underwhelming. Yeah. June starting to get better, but July it's like picking up. And I know August is going to be a really good month for us. So I think what you said is completely true. I think one, surrounding yourself with like customers. I speak to our teenagers all the time, like new users. I read all the comments. We're getting Apple reviews all the time. And those what make me realize, actually, we are 100% on to something. And it's not just the teens. It's when you start getting messages from parents as well. I'm like, okay, no, we're on to something. So I think keeping yourself grounded in like the mission and what you're building for. But then also just remembering that like something good will come and that you're just building the foundations for like a new partnership opportunity or a new TikTok to take off or, you know, getting one step closer to having the perfect formula for the conversion rate. And also speaking to other founders too. I do think like the founder community has just been amazing. You know, you're not the only one feeling this. Like it is hard at the moment. Fundraising is difficult. Like product market fit is difficult, but it is possible. And I think speaking to exited founders going through it has also been, so helpful and very grateful for those friends that I can speak really openly and honestly to.
Yeah. I love that. Thank you so much. So one of the things that we like to do is, oh, sorry, Maria, were you going to ask another question?
No. So one of the things we like to do at the end of the podcast is try to understand what you would have done differently. But we do in a very different way. We don't ask you directly.
Okay.
We ask you to imagine a scenario. So right now there's a time machine and you have to go back to Jazz.
Okay.
This is early. You know, you're thinking about Luna. You're just about to make the decision or you've just about made the decision. The time machine opens and you're there and you have 10 seconds before you're transported back here. What will you tell Jazz?
Am I going back to like my...
Yes.
Going back to before Luna?
Yes. Or like what just as you made the decision.
Beginning.
The beginning. Everything that's happened now hasn't happened. And you're going back to that Jazz and you have to tell her something. But you have just 10 seconds to do so. What will you tell her?
I'm going to tell her that you are going to build the best brand and product that teenagers across the world are going to be obsessed with. Keep going and have confidence in it. Because everybody told us you're never going to be able to make puberty cool. And we have. Like, we are trending on TikTok. Teens are sharing this app and we are changing lives. And I think we've done it. Like, we've got brand equity that no other teen brand has. And just keep going at it because it's so hard to get rid of that. And yeah, Luna's got it. So I think something to just give faith and to keep going and just believe. That's what I would say.
And one other question. What would you be doing if you weren't building Luna today?
Honestly, I say this to Joe all the time. When in those moments of doubt, I'm like, well, what else would we be doing? And then we're like, no, right, we've got to be doing this.
It can't have anything to do with tech or like...
I actually think I've really enjoyed content creation, TikTok, marketing, building channels and stuff. So I actually think I would do something in social media. If I had some spare time, I would like to do more stuff on TikTok around my creator journey, building a platform for teens. I want to inspire young girls to see what it's like to be an entrepreneur, to understand why you have to put premium on it, to understand that like good products aren't free. I want them to see what hustle goes behind that. I've thought about like, do I try and do it alongside this? You got to put a lot of time in to be a good creator. But I think that's probably what I would do next.
Yeah.
I love that.
Thank you so much
for joining us. This was so incredible. We hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you so much.
We did. Thank you very much.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Startup Leap, TSL for short. Leave a review. Tell us what you think of this episode on all of our platforms at the Startup Leap Pod. Do you have a question? Ask us and we'll ask our guests. Go to thestartupleap.io. See you next time.